Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Welcome to episode 178 of the Intercooler Podcast with me, Dan Prosser, and my co-host, Andrew Frankel. This week, we're talking about 60 years of the Porsche 911, because earlier this month, the 911 did celebrate its 60th anniversary. And so we've already recorded a couple of episodes to mark the occasion. This time, we're talking about the later cars, the water-cooled cars, from the sort of late 1990s to today. And actually, we look ahead into the future as well. But before that, we talk about the Singapore Grand Prix because it was such an exciting race. I'm not sure anyone really saw that coming. So we do talk about that for 15 minutes or something. But after that, we are into the water-cooled 911s. Before we get started, I will just remind you all to follow or subscribe to the Intercooler Podcast. Wherever you listen to it, whatever app you use, there will be a follow button or a subscribe button. Just hit that. It helps us massively. So thank you for doing that, and we'll get on with the podcast now. 911s can wait for a moment, Andrew, because we're recording this the day after, I think, the best Grand Prix of the year, the Singapore Grand Prix. A proper humdinger of an F1 race that was. First of all, huge credit to Carlos Sainz for, well, A, for winning that race. It was a tough race to win, and he put it on pole. Fantastic all weekend.
Yeah.
Before the summer break, I probably had Carlos Sainz down as a tier two driver.
Defo.
More of the, with respect to these guys, Checo Perez, you know, the Valtteri Bottas of this world.
Exactly. A really good number two.
But now, goodness me, I'm beginning to wonder if he belongs in that tier one category. Two pole positions since the break.
Yeah.
Won that race brilliantly.
Yeah.
Has it sort of changed your view of
No, science? It hasn't.
Hasn't it? Okay.
No, it hasn't. And I'll tell you why. I sound like I'm dissing the bloke, but I'm not. But to me, the case is not proven. We knew with, you know, Valtteri Bottas, he sometimes outqualified Lewis.
Yeah.
Just to be quick over a lap, Charles made a mistake. I mean, I think Charles was like, he qualified third, didn't he? And he was like 8,000th of a second off pole. And we'll come back to that because that's actually, it was Charles Leclerc who I think was instrumental in Ferrari winning that race. But anyway, I'll come back to that in a minute. So yeah, fine. Pole, congratulations, brilliant. And also capitalising on that moment when the Red Bulls filtered. Who saw that coming? Certainly not me. But in the race, the thing about the race was, and the thing which I think, I'm not saying that he isn't, I'm saying it's still unproven, is that he won that race by driving as slowly as possible.
Yeah. Brundle said that in commentary,
didn't he? He didn't win that race by just disappearing.
Yeah.
And what I, to me, the absolutely staggering thing about that race was it was a race won entirely on strategy from the worst strategists in the pit lane. Or historically.
They didn't look at it yesterday, did they?
Oh, my goodness. It was so clever. Mm. You know, using Leclerc as the plug to back the rest of the field up so no one could do the undercut, because they'd come back in, literally, you know, the field was so tightly packed that if you tried to pit stop early, they were saying this about, I think, Lewis or George, they'd rejoin the race in 18th place.
Mm.
On a circuit where it's really difficult to overtake.
Yeah.
So they just had to all just sit there and sit and sit and sit. And I just thought it was just a really, really smartly... That was probably strategically the best run race I've seen in I can't remember how long. They just nailed it. And absolutely key to it was getting Charles ahead of George at the start. And that's why they stuck him on softs.
On the softs, yeah.
And they just... I mean, you know, yes, clearly, you know, the safety cars worked in their favour. But they just nailed it. They just absolutely nailed it. And they set up that fantastic, what was it, 15 laps, the last 15 laps?
Yeah. Brilliant.
I mean, I didn't know where to look. I was standing up. I was just all over the place. And, I mean... from about 15 laps out, I just knew George was going to win that race. it was just obvious, wasn't it?
Until
he didn't.
And again, Sainz keeping Lando behind him just close enough that the McLaren had DRS, so it was very difficult to pass.
Again, that was so clever.
Brilliant.
Because he understood where the threat was, and he knew the threat wasn't Lando, because Lando's tyres were as shagged as his.
Mm.
He knew the threat was the Mercedes. It was just... If he hadn't kept Lando that close, and Lando hadn't had DRS, the Mercedes would have been past him in a heartbeat.
And then past the Ferrari as well.
And then past the Ferrari, which wouldn't have had DRS either.
Yeah, yeah. They would have come flying through if they got past that McLaren.
Absolutely.
So
that is a... And I don't know whether that was Carlos, who's obviously an extremely bright boy, or whether that was the pit talking to him and saying, no, you need to do this. But it was just a level of thinking. It was such a strategic game, wasn't it? It was like chess. I didn't foresee that outcome. I just thought the moment the Mercedes made that late stop, I thought they'd done it.
Yeah. And a few more laps than they would have done, wouldn't they? But I think it was Carlos who was choosing to give Lando the DRS. I think he made that decision, partly because there was that radio call saying it's on purpose or something. But a brilliantly executed race. As you say, there probably isn't yet enough evidence for us to conclude that Carlos Sainz belongs to that Tier 1 category just yet. But it's made me wonder. These last couple of races have made me wonder if I've got him wrong. Maybe we'll see over the rest of the season. I don't know.
But also, you know, drivers develop, don't they? They turn into different animals. Also, can we talk about George for a bit? And also the George and Lewis.
Can we come to that in a moment? Just because I just want to acknowledge Lando. Fantastic result. Lando Norris in the McLaren second. Brilliant. The McLaren looks rapid at the moment. Also, Liam Lawson.
Yes.
In the AlphaTauri, finished ninth, scored 2 points on his third Grand Prix.
Yeah.
I mean, wow. That is a very, very difficult circuit and a difficult Grand Prix if you've only competed in two before. So he did fantastically. I mean, he's also looking...
As a circuit, it's absolutely merciless.
Yeah.
It's, you know, and one of the reasons I like it so much, because it's, you know, it's a circuit of consequence.
Mm.
It's not like... the purpose-built circuits, or even circuits that have been adapted, or even circuits, I'm afraid, like Spa these days, where you can literally just leave the track and drive into another county and just rejoin. In Singapore, you leave the track, you're in the wall. As we found out with George, you know, stuff happens, doesn't it? I think for a rookie to drive, and also the physicality of that circuit in the heat. To be that fit, to be that mentally strong, to not make a mistake when it's your third Grand Prix and come home halfway up the field in a car which was, you know, that's the best that car was ever going to do, wasn't it? Absolutely.
And
cracking effort.
He needs a full-time race seat for 24, doesn't he? And Daniel Ricciardo, maybe it makes his position in F1 a little bit more complicated. But yeah, huge credit to Liam Lawson. Okay, let's get on to the Mercedes point then, because that was fascinating.
Yeah.
So let's just set this up. So Esteban Ocon's car failed, and he pulled in at the pit lane exit, and they had to throw the VSC, the virtual safety car, with 15, 16 laps to go to clear that car. The leaders stayed out.
Yep.
The Mercedes came in, George and Lewis. They put on those lovely new medium tyres that they'd saved from practice on Friday. And they had, it was something like 15 laps to chase down 13 and a half seconds, I think was the gap to Charles, certainly, who was running third at that time. And it was a case of, are they going to be quick enough to catch and pass the leading cars for one of them to take the win? And it was, you couldn't set it up more enticingly, could you? So to watch, it was fantastic.
So they had to gain about 1.5 seconds a lap to win the race. And they set off, and the numbers were just extraordinary. Mm. You know, sometimes George was taking 2 seconds out of the lead in a lap around that, because they were on brand new mediums against cars that were on completely shagged halves. And as I said, as we said earlier, we just thought they were going to do it. But then it was so interesting, and this is where I just thought that Lewis just showed all his class and cleverness, because George just took off, and he actually pulled out a gap of about 3.5-4 seconds over Lewis straight after that pit stop.
But they had to stack the cars, didn't they? So George was always going to get away from that pit stop with an advantage.
Yeah, they had to an extent, but what George did was he just went off like a hare. And Lewis didn't. As a result, when he got to when it actually mattered, George obviously got held up because he got in the dirty air behind Lando. And Lewis was able to close up on him. And at the end of it, Lewis's tyres were in much better condition than George's. So the question is, what should Mercedes have done then? So I think you can make an argument for everything other than what they did. So you could say, well, George arrived on the scene first. So you'd say to Lewis, right, back off completely, let George have a fair crack at it. Because with the two fighting with each other, as we all know, when cars go up against each other, both cars slow down, which is the last thing that they wanted. Alternatively, you could have just said, well, actually, you know, Lewis is faster now, his tyres are in better nick, swap them over and let Lewis have a go. But as a result of them fighting with each other, George made a mistake, ended up on the wall, and Lewis came home third. And I think actually what they should have done is they should have swapped them around and said, George, back off today. It's not your day. Sorry, guy. But Lewis has got better tyres. He's quicker. He is the person to go and have a go at Lando. And also, we all know that, you know, that Lewis's racecraft and his overtaking ability is absolutely second to none. And Lewis, in those very particular circumstances, presented the Mercedes team with the best chance of winning that race.
I agree. I think that was their best chance.
And I think he could have done it. And I think if he'd got past... who knows? I mean, you know, the whole world of motor racing is ruled by the rule of what if. But I think if he got past Lando, he'd have got past Carlos.
I think, yeah, that's right. If you can get past the Mercedes with... Sorry, if you can get past the McLaren with DRS, you get past the Ferrari without it in no
exactly.
time at all. So yeah. I agree. I think that was Mercedes' best chance of winning that race. However, goodness me, if they'd made that call to George to pull aside... Is that the end of team unity at Mercedes? Are the repercussions far greater? It would be... Oh, George, he would just be furious, because he would always have backed himself to get past those leading cars.
But he wasn't. He was stuck behind Lando for a long time, and he wasn't making... He didn't make a convincing... So he couldn't do it. And I think in those circumstances, the team is entirely within his rights, to say... Look, George, we understand why this is. It's not your fault. Your tyres are gone. But Lewis is quicker than you at the moment. He is the person for the team who is best placed to do this. And just think what would have happened if Mercedes had actually won a race this year, if Lewis had become the first person in history to win a Formula One race after having taken 300 starts. No one's done it yet.
Oh, really?
No one had won a race past their 300th Formula One race. Wow. And Lewis, I don't know where he is. He must be up near 350, 360 now. Oh, God, I hope I'm right about that. I think I am. Someone will tell me if I'm not. But I think I'm right about that. And yeah, and the other thing, so we need to talk about, you know, can you believe we got this far into a conversation about Formula One? We haven't actually mentioned Red Bull yet.
I know.
But that's the other massive talking point. But, you know, I think what I thought was so impressive about the whole Ferrari effort was they knew this was a proper chance, that this was a proper opportunity, because for some reason, Red Bull wasn't firing. For myself, and again, I got this completely wrong, I just thought, okay, fine, so they weren't great in qualifying, they're not suited to the circuit, but we know how gentle the Red Bull is in its tyres, and we know how strong its DRS is, and a combination of those two would really, really pull him up. I'm not sure I thought that Max would necessarily win it, but I thought he would be right up there. And actually, I think the car was so poor. I think, where did he come in the end? Sixth? Fifth?
Fifth, yeah. I mean, it was sixth Fifth. Until Josh put it in the wall, wasn't it?
Yeah. I think he did amazingly to come back through the way that he did. And I think that's, you know, pretty good. I think it's quite impressive because, you know, if you think about it, when did Max last have to fight? When did Max have to last really get his elbows out and bully his way past cars on a really difficult circuit? And yeah, he can still do it, can't he?
Yeah, he can. I think that it was so bizarre to watch that Red Bull that has been, well, it's won every race so far until yesterday this year. It has been the dominant car, without question. Max coming off the back of winning 10 in a row, new record. To see him not manage to get out of Q2, beaten by Liam Lawson in the AlphaTauri on his third Grand Prix.
I mean,
just amazing. It's so bizarre that circuit characteristics can make that much of a difference to a car that has worked everywhere else.
And we think that it is, don't we? Because all the inside view about these, they're not regulation changes, are they? I think they're just tightening of the regulations about flexible floors and that sort of thing. Whether they affect the Red Bull more than anything else or not, I think what everybody has agreed is that effect would be least seen at a circuit like Singapore. I did speak to Karun about this, and we will see. His view is that it's a flash in the pan. He thinks that come Suzuka next weekend, Max will be off into the distance again. Don't know.
We'll see. Right,
if that's the case, somebody, who was it? I think it was the Car Factoids on Twitter, came on and was mentioned something about this. This will be 1988. If Red Bull then go off and win every other race of the season, it'll be 1988 all over again. It'll be Monza 88.
With Ferrari winning the one that the dominant team didn't manage to win.
Yeah, exactly.
So on the Red Bull thing, there is a sort of bigger point here to make. And that's, whenever a driver dominates in Formula One, so much of that is down to the car. And that's true of every driver who has dominated, certainly in the modern era, Verstappen, Hamilton, Vettel, Schumacher. Once they don't have the competitive machinery anymore, they're nowhere. As we saw Max not getting out of Q2 because his car just was not working. Lewis hasn't been winning races since the end of 2021 because the car hasn't been there. Vettel, we saw how he dropped off. Schumacher, later on in his career, it happens time and again. Once they don't have competitive machinery, they are not able to make the difference. And it's almost an uncomfortable truth for Formula One, because we tend to want to make heroes of the drivers and say it's down to them. But in reality, the car is a huge, huge part of it. And it's right that it's that way, because F1 is just too competitive. The level is too high. There are too many fantastic drivers there for any one driver, even the very best in the world, to overcome deficient machinery. You know, the likes of Lewis and Fernando and Charles and George and Lando, they are too good for a driver with a car that's not working to be quicker than them. And so the point ultimately is that whenever a driver is dominating, we need to give the designers and the team a huge amount of the credit, because it's a big part of it is the car.
Yeah. At the same time, however, where you can see it is between teammates, and that is the mark of the truly extraordinary driver. You know, take Schumacher, okay, forget the Mercedes bit when he was, you know, he probably shouldn't have come back and done that. But when he was Ferrari, at Ferrari, he absolutely destroyed his teammates. And if you look at Max, what he's doing to Perez, he's doing it too. And they do it for two reasons, don't they? They do it, one, because they are of these ridiculous natural talents they have, but also because the team knows where the opportunities lie, and they design the car around that opportunity, and that opportunity is Max. And so they design, and what they do is they design a car for one driver to the detriment of the other. So actually what happens is the gap between them gets bigger because people can't drive. I mean, but, you know, if you take, you know, particularly you know, the ones I know about are Michael and Max, and they had very similar driving styles. They like really, really pointy cars. They like cars which fly into the apex, get, and they back themselves to control, you know, the rear end of the car. And if you're a car, if you're a driver who much prefers a car with a bit of nice reassuring steady state understeer, that's really problematic for you.
It was why Albon never really made much of an impression during his stint at Red Bull. And actually, we know Albon's a fantastic driver.
Oh, do you know, I think he might be the most underrated driver on the grid. Yeah. I've always said this, actually. I thought, you know, I can remember him overtaking someone on the grass at 200 miles an hour at the top of Radeon on a race and just thinking, you've got something. Mm. And but yes, absolutely. He blew his opportunity at Red Bull, didn't he?
Mm. Yeah, he couldn't get on with the car that was built around Max. No. And actually, someone made an important point about this. If Mercedes does build a properly competitive car for next year, they're not going to back one of their drivers. They have this. They now have this sort of equal number one status policy, it seems. That might hurt them, you know, because Red Bull are going to back one of their drivers. Mm. Mercedes, their drivers will take points off each other.
Yeah, but you know, I think there's you know, there's wise words, and I think there's good intention. But then I think there's also after that there's reality, and if. You know, but I think one of the reasons it's going to be difficult for them in the way that it's simply not difficult for Red Bull is it's bloody obvious who the number one driver at Red Bull is. I don't think it's obvious at all who the number one driver at Mercedes is.
No.
You know,
actually, I disagree with that. I think they're very level in qualifying, but Lewis is 71 points ahead of George now. It's a big old gap.
It's a big old gap, yeah, but, you know, but last season, I don't know what the gap was, but, you know, George out-qualified him.
No, Lewis out-qualified him last season.
Did he?
But George outscored him, yeah.
Yeah, I think it is not at all obvious who is the better driver of those two.
I disagree with that. I think, and I think yesterday was quite a good demonstration. Certainly in the races, I think Lewis still has his nose ahead. But anyway, it's what we're going to see for the remainder of the season. I think, as you've already hinted, I think we're just going to see Max run away with the rest of them, aren't we?
Well, I only think that because, you know, that seems to be the opinion of people who know far more about it than I do. You know, they were so far off the pace. I struggle to think there's not something else going on. I guess we'll find out next weekend. You know, clearly, you know, it was a circuit to which neither Max nor his car were suited. You know, it must be one of very, very few races on the calendar now that Max has never won. Mm. So there was that. You know, they got unlucky. They got really unlucky with the safety car in the same way that Ferrari got lucky. So, you know, there are lots of reasons that, you know, for Red Bull, it was a really, really bad weekend for almost every reason. Ferrari, you know, also got it absolutely right. Now, take out those variables and just go back to a sort of normal race weekend, I guess you still have to have the Red Bull, you know, you definitely still have to have Max going off and winning it. But I don't know. We all see, won't we? Mm. Yeah, Suzuka will be. I mean, the great thing is, it, you know, Suzuka is next weekend, and it's such an amazing circuit. Mm. And it's actually, in the way that it is configured, it's kind of, although it's, you know, fantastic spectacle and everything else, it's actually quite a good indicative circuit of general pace because it is, you know, there is a lot of high speed stuff. There's a lot of aero requirement. I think we'll know in a week.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one of a kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you found the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door.
Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Let's move on then to water-cooled 911s, right? Yep. So it was on the 12th of September, a week ago, that the 911 turned 60. It was the original 911, still called 901, as we know, was unveiled at the Frankfurt Motor Show in 1963 on the 12th of September. And so we have been marking the occasion throughout this year, haven't we? We've done two other podcasts dedicated to the 911. Episode 161 was all about the 911 in racing. Episode 154 was all about the early 911s, air-cooled 911s. Mm. And now this, the water-cooled 911s. And it starts with the 996 in 1997. Yeah. The first all-new 911 since the original. Mm-hmm. What do you remember of the 996 coming along? I mean, I was 10 years old or something, not really aware of it, but did it feel like I was a bit older than that. No, you weren't. A little bit. Did it feel like a huge departure? Did it feel like Porsche was taking great strides forward or getting it horribly wrong? What do you remember?
When I drove it and I wrote my review for, I was editing Motorsport magazine at the time, the headline was 9, as in N-E-I-N, the German for not 11. Mm. Because I actually thought the car was quite impressive. You know, you forget, don't you, that it was quite a lot lighter than the 993, despite being bigger.
Yeah.
And it had, you know, quite a lot more power. Now it had this 300 horsepower, 3.4 litre, all-new flat six. Little did we know what problems lurked within. Mm. But it just didn't feel to me like a 911. It felt like a much more touring, less sporting. And I didn't even mean it in any kind of pejorative sense. I just felt it felt like much more like a normal car. And I was in two minds about it. To answer your question, it absolutely felt like a complete break from everything that had come before. A new dawn, for good or for bad. And it would be interesting. Maybe we should go and do it. Maybe we should go and get an early 996 and a late 993 and just try the two of them together and see whether, you know, what I thought, when was it, 98? So 25 years ago. Still holds true. But yes, it was a completely and utterly different experience.
The trouble with trying to assess these cars now, and I've only driven a few 996s and fairly briefly at that, particularly a Carrera that I drove, you know, they are 20-something years old now. You're not really sure how well they've been maintained.
No.
How old the tyres are, what kind of life is left in the suspension, the brakes. So it can be difficult to get a read on what a 996 Carrera, in this instance, actually feels like.
Absolutely. It's the same with all old cars.
Yeah, it's true. It is universally true. But I, on a very, very brief drive, and not a quick one either, I just felt like the 996 felt a bit baggy and a bit loose and not the taut, responsive sports car I was expecting. But presumably you have a sort of better understanding of what a good one should feel.
I do. I mean, only because I drove them when they were brand new. I think we were all aware that the quality had taken a dive at the time. It certainly felt that way when it was new. And, you know, we know why that was. We know that, you know, Porsche had been making cars totally uneconomically. And the company was in, you know, a very, very bad state. It's one of the reasons that basically they, one of the few things that get, that essentially got carried over was the rear suspension from the 993, because it saved an enormous amount of money. So, you know, and obviously there was the commonality with the Boxster, with the 986, which is basically the same car from the windscreen forward, and then many, many other components in common. And it did feel like a car of less intrinsic quality. And yes, there was, I mean, I don't think I would have characterized it by any sort of bagginess at the time, because, you know, the car would have been obviously on new springs and new dampers and new bushes and everything else. It just didn't feel like, you know, you were locked in a vault, in the way that, you know, those earlier cars had. What I do remember, and I think what would surprise anyone who went and drove an early 996 now, I just remember thinking, this is a really fast car. I don't know why I didn't expect that. But yeah, the more performance power, of those weight. Cars.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that is, you know, I can... Actually, I borrowed one. I suppose in the last couple of years, because somebody borrowed one of my cars and they just had one of these things lying around. So I just went home and back in it. And it had done 150,000 miles. It was a baggy old 996. But I was still struck by how quick it felt. Mm. And that was, you know, very recently. So, yeah.
We did drive, didn't we, a GT3 RS, a 996 GT3 RS.
Yeah, that didn't feel baggy.
No, goodness me. No, it didn't feel baggy. That was an exciting car to drive.
Yes.
Actually, for me, it felt a little bit uncomfortable on some of the roads that we were driving it on. Like, it was actually optimised for very smooth roads. But fantastic engine and gearbox, great steering. And a proper live wire, energetic, thrilling car.
Yes, but so different. I mean, you know, point one is it had the Metzger engine in it, so it didn't have the same engine that you know, normal 996s had. Point two, it was the most track oriented GT3 RS of them all until the current one. You know, that's what it was set up for. I mean, they wanted a big difference between a GT3 and a GT3 RS, and it was also an extremely low volume, very specialized piece of kit, and that's what happens. So, you know, it's in no way indicative of 996s generally. I just wonder, you know, it's very difficult to talk about 996s or even 997s without the issue of the engine coming up and just how dependable it is or it isn't. What's your view? Do you think that you should just say to someone, you know, unless the engine has been done, don't go near it? Or would you say go into it with your eyes open? How serious is this problem? What do we think is the best advice to anybody? Because it's such a tempting thing, isn't it? You desperately want a 911. And, you know, if you want a cheap 911, then, you know, a 996 is clearly going to be where you end up. But they do have, well, they certainly have this reputation of having a ticking time bomb under their engine cover.
Yeah, so what is it? It's the IMS, the intermediate shaft, isn't it?
Yeah.
And on some of them, the rear main oil seal.
Seal,
and then there's the bore scoring issue as well.
Yeah.
So, goodness me, and there is an awful lot that you need to be aware of, isn't there? But it's a very good question to ask, because I've idly on many occasions looked at cheap 996s and slightly less cheap 997s, but I've always been made to feel quite nervous by these issues, because if you have one of them, you're looking at probably a five-figure bill, and that would be ruinous for me and for many other people. I could afford one of the cars, but if that happens, how are you going to explain that to your other half? Why you can't go on holiday? Why you can't whatever?
Yeah, I mean, it's serious, isn't it? And my understanding, which may not be your understanding, is that broadly speaking, it's not a question of if it's going to happen, but when. But there are ways around it. You know, there are fixes, and once it's done, isn't it?
So maybe the solution is to only buy a car that has had the remedial work done.
Yeah. But you might take a view that this car is going to be a recreation. It's not going to do a load of miles. Maybe it hasn't already got a load of miles on it. And maybe you'll just think, well, I'll take the chance. Mm. I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't, because I just couldn't sleep at night knowing that, you know, that potential was, you know, sat out there, you know, in the shed or whatever. I couldn't have a car which wasn't done. Or I'd just get a turbo if I possibly could afford it.
Now, hold that thought. But the other thing about 996s and 997s is they do have these engine issues that can be terminal or very costly. But there are other bits as well. You know, you do need to stick... I spoke to someone who really knows... He's got one. He knows about this stuff. And he says you have to put a couple of £1,000 a year into them, servicing and maintenance, just to keep on top of stuff. And when jobs do need doing, they are expensive. And when you need replacement parts, they're not cheap. So you can buy one for, I don't know, what, 15 grand or something, a 996, but they are going to cost you money. So you do need to be aware of that. I suppose it's inevitable, isn't it? It's a Porsche sports car. Thinking you can run one on a shoestring is probably naive. So 996 Turbo, I'm glad you mentioned that because, well, they're becoming expensive now. But I think they look fantastic. As you say, they have the Mesger engine, so they don't have the engine issues. A load of power, four-wheel drive, manual box. I mean, goodness me.
I mean, there was a time when they were the sort of, you know, the great secret, weren't they? They were the bargains. They were because they go like smack. If you got on one today, you know, it might be 20-something years old, but, you know, you're not going to sit there thinking, well, this is very fast. You'd think, wow. you would be thinking, wow.
Yeah.
You know, you're talking about something which could pull an early 3 to 60. I mean, it's that fast, which is going to get your attention. Yeah, you know, so...
And are they good to drive, though? I've never driven one.
Define good. Yeah. By ultimate 911 standards, no. By most other standards, yes. You know, for you, it's always been the same with turbos, isn't it? You know, because you lose the sound and you lose the throttle response and you lose some of the rev range. And you get a massive whack in the back as a return. But they're heavier. So, no, I wouldn't say that they were anywhere near my list of top 10, you know, 911 driving machines. But, you know, at the same time, if you want a car which is going to go really, really fast, look really cool, still really good to drive, I think there's a lot to be said for them. Just don't think they are going to, you know, drive like a GT3, because they just don't.
No. I saw a very standard, early 997 Carrera S on the road the other day. I mean, there are plenty of them. You see them all the time. But it was just sort of prowling through town. And I just thought it looked fantastic. Such a simple, clean shape. Beautiful in a way.
Much prettier car than the 996.
Yeah, agreed.
I can't get my head around the headlights of the 996.
No. Actually, do you know what? I remembered speaking to Tony Hatter, the Porsche designer, about that. Yeah. Why they chose those fried egg headlamps. And it's because it's a totally new car, completely different to the 993. And they had to underline that somehow with how the car looked. And so they went with that weird headlight design. But anyway, this 997, I just thought a gorgeous looking thing. And I regularly dip into the classifieds and have a little ponder about these. As I've already said, the engine issues do make me, do put me off. But they,
if I was going to get a 911 of that era, not my favourite one, but the one which I thought of the more affordable ones was the best, that's what I'd get. I'd get a 997 Carrera S that had the work done.
Yeah.
That, to me, I think is the sweet spot of that range. In terms of when you try to balance what it's like in terms of, as a car to drive and what they cost to buy. I think a nicely sorted 997 Carrera S is an absolutely cracking piece of kit.
No, I think the facelifted one, and this is contemporary for me now, because I was just about a motoring journalist working on a car magazine when the 997-2 was launched, and I remember driving it when it was new. Now, they had revised engines, or maybe totally different engines. I think direct fuel injection engines.
Yeah, they had DFI on them, yes.
So they don't have the same issues, do they?
I think that's correct. No. They finally got on top of them. So maybe they're the ones to go for.
Facelift 997 Carrera S. Yeah, I would love one of those. While we're talking about 997s, we do have to talk about the GT3 RS. The 997 2 GT3 RS 3.8. It's a ridiculous Hebe. Name, but Hebe, if you know what I'm talking about, you'll know exactly what car that is. I think it's probably my favourite road car.
Of all?
I think so. Well, one of them. It's in the top sort of 3, 4, 5. It's right up there.
I wouldn't argue, yeah.
And Porsche GB have this, you just mentioned it, didn't you, on their heritage fleet. The reg plate is HBY, they call it Hebe.
Yeah.
And that is, it's about the most extreme example of that car you can get because it has no infotainment of any kind. It has no AC, which makes it a bit ridiculous in the summer on a really hot day. But goodness me, that is a wonderful car.
We've talked about it on this podcast in at least one previous episode, and I think it's going to become a sort of cliche if it isn't already. But I think the phrase "peak 911" has been used in relation to it. The thing is, if you go and drive this car, what would that be? He'd be a 2010 car, I guess.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
So it's already more than a dozen years old. You go and drive, it's got 450 horsepower, which is, it's a lot, but it's not an enormous amount. You go and drive it, you're never, ever going to think to yourself, oh, I wish this had another 100 horsepower, or I wish this went round a corner quicker. You're just going to adore the way it drives. It's the feel of the car. It's the way that it just puts you in touch and how immediate it is. I'm not expressing myself very well. It's just magical, isn't it? It's just a fantastic thing to be in. And it just feels special. You are aware of this sense of occasion, which you don't get in so many other cars, including many 911s. You're just aware that you are driving something which is just, it's almost greater than the sum of its parts. It's just one of those cars that came out even better and even more right than really anybody could have possibly expected. Magnificent car.
But it's supple as well, isn't it? It's not a bone
shaker. Yeah, it does ride.
It rides really well. So I love that thing. Question is, the GT3 RS 4-litre, the very limited edition run-out special, is that a better car?
It's a better car because it's got more torque. It's got a bit more power, quite a lot more power. It's 500 horsepower, isn't it? But you feel the mid-range more. But they are so rare and such special things. I don't think we should necessarily be delayed by it too much. But yes, it was. There are no downsides to that car. It is an even better version. It is ultimately the one to have if you've got however many hundreds of thousands of pounds tucked away to go and get one.
I'd actually have the 3.8.
Why?
Just a bit more supple. I'd love to drive them back to back. Maybe we need to do that at some point. But my sense is that the 3.8 is a bit more supple and on our roads, better because of it. But
were the 4 litres much stiffer?
A little bit, I think. A little bit. Okay. I remember I drove one fairly recently and I remember thinking exactly that. So that's the 907. Let's clip through them onto the 991. I remember when the 991 was new. I just started on Evo magazine. And people were saying Porsche had dropped the ball with that car.
People said it with the 996, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. But there were some important changes, weren't there? It had that 7-speed manual that wasn't really well sorted at that point.
The big change was the wheelbase.
Yeah, and electric steering.
Electric steering, exactly. Electric steering and the wheelbase. Mm. They put 100 mil extra in the wheelbase.
Yeah.
The thing about on top of the extension to the wheelbase that had already happened with the 996. Mm. One of the core reasons that 911s felt like 911s in those early days, it wasn't just that they had a flat six engine swinging around at the back. It was because they had tiny wheelbases, and so they would change direction and they would pivot. That's also one of the reasons they were so lively. When that agility got a bit too agile and things started wandering around. And then, as you say, the 991 came along, and its wheelbase is still short, by the standards of, you know, comparable cars, because it doesn't have to have an engine within it. But even so, compared to, you know, even a 996, 997, let alone a 964, 993. Yeah, and the electric steering. Mm. And, you know, I did this once. I can't remember what we were driving. It must have been a 991 GT3 RS, but we were somewhere and they had Hebe there. And so I took the 991 GT3 RS out with the 997 GT3 RS. And that's what I remember more than anything else. I can just remember thinking the 997, it just steered. There was just so much more feel, so much more communication. Mm. You just felt so much more part of the machine in the older car. It was, again, not as big a change as from 993 to 996, but still a complete, you know, only the third start again car.
Yeah.
In however many years it was.
Just the Carreras then, the basic model. Did you think Porsche had got that wrong at the time? This is 2011 or something. Yeah, around there. 2012 maybe.
Depends what you mean by wrong. I thought that they had designed a very canny car. I thought they had, and I said this before, I thought they designed a 911 for someone who didn't want a 911. so someone, you know, a car for someone who wanted all the image of a 911. Look at me, I drive a 911. But actually just wanted a, you know, a daily driver, which was, you know, quiet, comfortable, fast and everything else. So it depends how you measure it. I mean, for me, you know, those early 991s were not as good to drive, you know, really quite some distance from being as good to drive as what the 997 turned into, and, you know, those late cars. But, you know, I wasn't the target market.
Mm. Yeah, exactly right.
And those, you know, those naturally aspirated engines, which were lovely, but, you know, as we know, the gear ratios were not best suited and they didn't have an enormous amount of mid-range torque, and that didn't necessarily sit well with the cars. I think the second generation cars, when they got the turbo engines, actually, for what they were, they were better suited to the turbo engines than the naturally aspirated ones which came in the Gen 1 cars. And I'd never have said that. If they'd done that with the 997, I'd never have said that. But actually, I think the character of the car, generally speaking, is better suited to the turbo motor than to the atmospheric ones.
If I ever do buy a 911, and I'm, you know, not a ridiculous, fanciful six-figure car, it would be a 991 Gen 2, a facelift 991 Carrera of some sort with the twin turbo engine. That's the one that I would sort of
a T, covet. Maybe,
yeah, maybe a T. Yeah, yeah, lovely car. Talking of facelift 991s, the GT3 Touring, I think, is about as good as these very recent 911s have got.
Oh, absolutely. I know someone who's got a silver debadged manual GT3 Touring, 991 GT3 Touring.
Yeah. That's the one.
Bloody wonderful, it really is.
Now, the current one, the 992 GT3 Touring... fantastic engine and gearbox, obviously. Looks great. On the right road, really sublime to drive, but it has become quite uncompromising. Mm. And we drove that car a couple of months ago, didn't we, alongside two other 911s. And it is a fabulous thing. But I would still pick the older 991.
Oh, as a car to use on the road, I think unquestionably.
Mm.
You know, the other big departure, well, I mean, the GT3, the standard GT3 has been configured that way because it's, you know, it's got a whole lot of downforce, which the Touring doesn't have. And that is why I was surprised they left the Touring on the same suspension. You know, the GT3 needs it because it needs to support the body under the weight of all that downforce. But it's also got this double wishbone front suspension, which does bring many more benefits, but it does also make it a very different sort of driving proposition. But no, I completely agree with you. I think if you were going to have a GT3 Touring the 991 is just a better car for that.
The last specific 911 that I want to talk about, because we are running out of time, is the current GT3 RS. I've only driven it on track.
I've done both now.
Yes, you have, haven't you? And so I drove it on a wet track that ultimately did dry. And then you do discover this a phenomenal amount of grip and performance and stability and high speed stuff and all the rest of it. I'm much more interested in what it's like to drive on the road because it's gone pretty hardcore now.
You know what? When the Goodwood Festival, the only reason I've driven it on the road was when the Goodwood Festival of Speed got, what was it, winded off on the Saturday. They had to shut it on the Saturday. And we were all staying locally. And Porsche had brought their GT3 RS along. And we had nothing to do for the day. So I just went for a trot up the road. And what I found was so amazing is that because you can it's so configurable, if you just slackened everything off, it rides.
Does it?
That was the amazing
thing.
Yeah, it does ride. Yeah.
That's me.
You know, I would say that it rides better than a GT3.
Wow.
In fact, I wouldn't say that. It does ride better than a GT3. It allows you to, you know, slacken off the dampers. Mm. And it's actually... Okay, I probably drove it 30, 40 miles. It was in West Sussex, so probably not the most challenging of roads. But I thought the car would just really, really annoy me because it'd be skipping and bucking and kicking. And it didn't do any of those things.
Mm. Yeah.
It was really nice. And I think it is such a clever car. And clearly that's the way that, you know, configurability is going to be the way that, you know, believe me, you know, in very short period of time, you're going to be able to do all these whizzy things with the Ferraris and all the other stuff that comes up because it's so, A, it's stuff to play with, B, it looks cool, and C, you know, you can talk to your mates about, oh, you're in your ideal configuration, and it makes you look like you know what you're doing, even if you probably don't. But it just really, really works. And I was fantastically impressed by it. My only problem with that car is it doesn't have a boot.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you can't go anywhere in it.
Yeah. You can't even pack your helmet and an overnight bag and go to the ring with a mate.
No, well, I mean, I suppose you can stick it in the back where the rear seats should be if you haven't got some massive roll cage sat there. But no, it's not ideal. But I do think it's a very, very clever car. I know it's more expensive, but, you know, and I know that they're very difficult to get anyway. But to me, that is a much... What's the word? I think it's a much smarter, better resolved, more clear-eyed 911 than a standard GT3.
Interesting. Wow. Interesting. We really are running out of time. So 60 years of the 911...
What's
and at
next?
This point, yeah, that's right, it's impossible not to look ahead. Maybe not 60 years, that's a bit too far down the line, but I don't know, 10, 20 years? And the big question for the 911 is, how do you electrify it, whether that's hybrid or full EV? Now, I'm confident that Porsche could build a sports car with little rear seats, selling for £100,000+, powered by batteries and electric motors, and I'm sure it could be pretty good to drive. But can it be a 911? Or is a flat six engine slung out the back with that weird weight distribution? Is that too intrinsic to the 911 proposition for an EV version to ever actually work?
I think the intriguing thing about that question, and it is clearly the question, is I don't think even Porsche knows the answer to it. You know, it's interesting, I mean, how far they're just kicking this down the road. You know, the 992, which came out in 2019, that's configured to take a hybrid. And it hasn't yet. We're 2023 as we record this now, so we're 4 years into the 992. So there's going to be a Gen 2 992 within the next year, I would think. Will that have a hybrid in it? My guess is that it won't, because it doesn't need to. I can remember talking to Frank Valliser when he was Mr. 911, and you know, he was in no hurry at all to lose a load of boot space to battery packs, to put a lot of weight into the car, none of which it's, you know, it needed to, you know, to hit its marks. I think that feeling still holds sway in Stuttgart. My guess, and it is absolutely a guess, is that the next generation of 911, so whatever succeeds the Gen 2, 992, the 99, whatever they decide to call it.
Four. Yeah.
Will have a hybrid drive. I think it'll have to.
Mm.
But Porsche have said, I think, that it is the last Porsche that will become electrified. But we know that there's an electric Boxster and an electric Cayman coming down the tracks. We know that since the existence of the Boxster, 26-27 years ago, that they have had considerable parts commonality with the 911. So clearly what's going to happen the next all-new 911 platform, and you've got to remember that 911s tend to come in pairs in terms of their design. So there was the 964 and the 993, which are closely related, the 996 and the 997, which are closely related, the 991 and the 992, which are closely related. So we're due an all-new one. And I'll eat my hat if that's not off the same platform that could be fully electrified, because it'll have to be the same platform that the Cayman and the Boxster, which we already know are going to be electrified, sit upon. So, but does that actually mean it will be fully electric itself? I don't think they'll be in any hurry to do that. So I think what you will get is hybrids. They may not even be plug-ins, but I'd be very, very surprised, actually, if the next 911 wasn't a hybrid. I don't think they'll just do a non-hybrid version. I think they'll all be hybrids, and we'll see how that works, how much weight it adds, what it adds, what it loses. But I think it's the way the world's going. And if you're going to do an old generation of car, you can't stick your head in the sand and forget what's happening and just hope that, the world
goes away.
It all goes away, because it won't. So I think it'll have to.
Well, we'll see, won't we? Bring it on. Mm. There you go. 60 years of the 911, three episodes dedicated to the 911 this year. Hopefully that was interesting to listen to. Now, we've got a listener question coming up in a moment on a very unusual engine configuration. But before we do that, I will remind you all, first of all, to rate and review the podcast. A good review, please. A very positive one. And hit whatever app you're listening to this on. It's most likely Apple. It might be Spotify, or actually any one of many others, Google, whatever else. But there will be a follow button or a subscribe button. Just hit that, and it means you don't ever miss an episode of the Intercooler podcast, but it also means that we find a bigger audience, so it helps us enormously. So
everybody wins.
Now, the listener question comes from Sean Drift. Good name. Why do car makers not produce V4 engines?
Ooh. That's it.
Yeah,
okay. Fine. Well, they have. God, V4s. So, who's had V4s? God, my lack of knowledge here. So, Saab had one. Ford had one. Actually, Lancia had one, didn't they? Although it was sort of a V4. It was one of those incredibly narrow engines. You think of like a VR6 engine,
where
you've got these very, very narrow, like 15-degree angles, and they all sit under the same head. Mm. Okay, so this is where I expose my complete lack of engineering knowledge. I mean, the idea... Oh, Porsche had one. So name the V4 Porsche.
The 919.
The 919.
The Le Mans car,
The Le Mans car was a V4. And that was a V4 because it's very short, it's very stiff, and if you're going to hang an entire back end of the car off the end of it, and you want a... It's a 2-litre, wasn't it? So it was a tiny little engine, designed so that it didn't get in the way of your aero. So it works very well for that. There is something to do with, I don't know what you call it, harmonic resonance. You know, engines all, they say that a straight six is perfectly balanced.
Yeah.
And fours clearly aren't, and V4s absolutely aren't. So I think they run quite rough. And I think that refinement is an issue. And I'm struggling a bit now.
Presumably the packaging benefit isn't great enough, because an inline four... It's pretty easy to package.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. I was going to say that. I suspect that's it. I suspect that it's very simply, the disadvantages outweigh the advantages. I mean, it's quite an unusual configuration, isn't it? And as you say, it's, there's quite a bit to be lost, and probably not quite enough to be gained. Mm.
There you go, Sean Drift.
Good question. Thank you, Sean.
Hopefully an interesting answer to a very good question. Keep them
coming across.
It was a good
question. I'm sure the answer was very interesting.
Keep your questions coming. You can, however you like, you can email us info@the-intercooler.com, or you can just message us on Instagram or Twitter. But keep doing it, and we'll answer another one next week.
Bye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.